In this episode of the Ben Greenfield Fitness Show, the effects of cold and heat on blood glucose, a new way to increase heat shock proteins, my weekly routine, the effects of 5G on respiration, and much more.
Health, performance, nutrition, longevity, ancestral living, biohacking, and much more. My name is Ben Greenfield. Welcome to the show.
Well, Jay, it is, by my calculation, about 10:20 a.m. in the morning on, what day are we recording this? Wednesday. We are recording on Wednesday in late April, and I'm already thinking about dinner, man. I've been up to some wizardry.
Oh, I'm 3 hours ahead of you, so I'm definitely thinking about dinner. But do you have something special that you need to tell us about?
Oh, yeah. So I have a heart. As you know, I'm a fan of organ meats, and heart is one of them. I think heart just makes your heart healthy.
Uh-huh.
That's my stupid doctrine of signatures hypothesis.
So stupid.
Yeah, it is a pretty good rich source of mitochondrial rich tissue. Mm-hmm. But anyways, more importantly, you can make it taste really good. So I have been using kefir as a marinade.
Yeah.
It turns out that kefir is actually a really good marinade. You know, in the past I've used raw milk to like soak liver or heart or kidney or sweetbreads or anything else.
Right.
You know, it's way better than like, you know, the old school lemon juice, vinegar, tenderizing approach. But kefir works even better from the experience I've had in the past few weeks, because I've been making kefir and then I'll put it in little bags or glass Pyrex jars with the meat or the organ meats that I'm marinating. So what I did was I have this giant beef heart. The good folks at Belcampo Meats is where I got that one from. It's a regenerative farm down in Northern California. So they sent me this beef heart, and I soaked it in kefir for a day, and then got up this morning and transferred it into the crock pot with a bunch of bone broth. And then, again, this is my stupid woo-woo approach to cooking. I put a lot of red things in there, like a lot more like kind of red heart healthy compounds, like cayenne and paprika and chili flakes. Put a little cumin, a little curry powder in there, some turmeric, and a little bit of salt. And so that's going to go for about 10 hours at low in the slow cooker, and then we'll have tacos tonight. So we'll use those.
Nice.
You know the company Asiete. Have you tried any of their tortillas?
No.
They make all sorts of different grain-free, gluten-free tortillas, but their almond flour tortilla. I know everybody's going to be shouting about the oxalates and all that jazz, but yeah, I don't care. They taste amazing. So we'll have that with, you know, like cubed avocados and some radishes, some cabbage, and do like a taco night with heart taco.
I think it's going to be amazing. That sounds good. Wait, so do you mince up or like kind of like, I don't know, like smash up like you would beef, like just regular ground beef? Do you do the same thing to the heart to make it like a beefy texture, or do you just like slice it up, or what do you do for that?
Great question. So what I do is I trim the fat off the outside of the heart, because it has these little fatty layers on it.
Yeah.
And I put that off to the side while it's crock potting. And then at the end of the day, what I'll do is I'll take a cast iron skillet. I'll put the fat in the cast iron skillet along with some butter and some onions, and heat that up until the onions start to caramelize. And while that's heating up, I'll cube the heart. And then I toss the heart in with the fat, the butter, and the onions, and give it about a 10-minute saute or so on that cast iron skillet. And then that's what gets used as the taco filling. So I like to cube it. Yeah.
Oh, that sounds, it sounds pretty good. Even though, you know, I've tried a ton of different types of organ meats. I mean, growing up kind of in the South, and then my grandfather was a farmer. I mean, we pretty much ate everything. Heart was one that I never really had much of a problem with. I actually can digest heart better. I won't even say digest. I like the taste of heart better than I do, say, liver, actually, if you prepare it well. And my grandfather and grandmother always did it in buttermilk. They always soaked it in buttermilk.
Yeah.
And I always had a good time with it. And they never told me what it was. I just ate it as a child. So I was kind of thankful for that, but now it's just one of those things where I don't even think twice. I still have a harder time with liver, honestly.
Yeah, and I joke about the whole doctrine of signatures thing, but heart is actually super rich in coenzyme Q10, which has been shown to be particularly helpful for cardiovascular health, you know, especially if one is on a statin. But even in the absence of a statin, CoQ10 is one of the best things for your heart. So it turns out heart is actually good for your heart.
Yeah.
So
yeah,
there you have it.
Well, you said one of the things that you did was stupid, was that you put a bunch of red stuff into your meal. Why do you go red? Why do you consider that stupid?
Because hearts are red, so I thought I'd put red spices in it because I figured they'd pair well together. If it would have been a blueberry, I would have found some blue stuff.
Total sense.
I like to cook with color.
Me too, man.
How have you been?
I was telling you offline briefly that I guess we were technically online, but off the air. I'm friggin' tired, and I'm normally not tired. I'm normally a very high energy, peppy guy.
Yeah, you're usually pretty perky.
Yeah, I feel it, and I may not sound very tired right now, but that's just because like I haven't said maybe three words throughout the day, so this is the first time I'm like actually talking. But I'm really tired, Ben.
Okay, fill me in. Why are you so tired?
Well, so my wife and I actually, it's been about a week. The drum roll, please. No. We had our second child about a week and a half ago. And so his name is Micah Liam Wiles. He was born 9 pounds, 5 ounces. He was a big guy.
Wow.
Yeah, he's a big guy, but super healthy.
My apologies to your wife's vagina.
I know.
Where did you guys go C-section?
No. She was split wide open, but not from her stomach.
That's a nice visual.
Exactly right. It's a very nice visual. And if my wife listens to this, I may no longer be the co-host of the Ben Greenfield Fitness Podcast. She had him all natural, and it didn't look pleasant, but she's a trooper, man. And so it was weird. It was honestly weird having, because, you know, when we had Regan, our first son, he's 2 now, we had him when there was no such thing as COVID-19. So the hospital system was working as it, you know, would normally do it. But this whole birthing process was super strange because it was like a ghost town in the hospital. Like there was no one there other than physicians, nursing, you know, the other staff of the hospital. But each person who was giving birth only was allowed to have one other individual. So no family could come visit. It was just an odd process, but it was actually kind of nice because it was so incredibly quiet. But working
on like your own private hospital.
Yeah, it was.
So now you know what it feels like to be a billionaire and have a baby.
Right.
Just get your own ward.
Exactly.
Well, cool, man. First of all, congratulations.
Oh, thanks.
And Micah is a very strong name.
Oh,
I don't
thank you.
Really know of any famous? Are there any famous people named Micah?
Famous? I don't think so. No.
Yeah,
we went.
That's good.
We went biblical with Micah. Even though honestly,
I guess it is a biblical name, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Prophet Micah. So we went with it actually because I just liked the sound of it. I actually chose my first son's name Regan, and then I chose Micah. Again, if my wife hears this, she's probably going to beg to differ, you know, otherwise. But it actually was my choice, and I just really liked them. Thought they were strong names, especially with Micah. And so if we have any more, my guess is that I'll choose the next name.
That's amazing. Wow. Well, I'll have to put some heart in a little Ziploc bag and send it down to you as
Sip
a congratulatory
slap
on the back.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'd smoke a cigar with you, but all I have is heart. So
we'll just go
with that.
Maybe next time.
All right, so a few cool news flashes. Now I've been going ape nuts on Twitter and also Facebook as far as putting out a lot of research studies regarding, you know, COVID, the immune system, you know, ongoing research, the state of the vaccinations, etc. And all of that's over at twitter.com/BenGreenfield or facebook.com/BGFitness, depending on which flavor of social media that you guys like to be tracked by.
You have been
and,
active.
Yes. Yeah. Well, I steep myself in the literature every morning and just tweet out everything that I find. And this is the part of the show where we talk about a few of the more interesting takeaways. And I don't really want to talk about anything virus related because honestly, it's exhausting. And, and sometimes it's refreshing to not talk about Wuhan and 5G and conspiracy theories and Bill Gates and viruses and vaccinations and
Yeah,
get tired of it. Anyways, though, so here's something cool. I figured out how to, because, you know, as you know, and as we talked about, I just don't like to have my phone on. I especially don't like the Wi-Fi and the Bluetooth on, but I just don't even like the signal bouncing around. And, you know, of course, also anytime you're downloading whatever podcasts, audiobooks, anything else, you're using the data on your provider. Well, I figured out that you can plug your phone into the Ethernet. I'd never realized this before.
Right. Yeah. So I didn't want to steal your thunder, but yeah, I've been doing this for a while now. And actually, I haven't done it with my phone. I've been doing it with my tablet.
Never realized it. So I tweeted this out, but I just got the Thunderbolt to, I think it's a Thunderbolt. Is it Thunderbolt?
That plugs into the,
I don't know. It's called Lightning. Yeah. Okay. So Ethernet to Lightning adapter, and it works perfectly. And I can download files extremely quickly. I've been working in my office with my phone plugged in, and so my phone can be doing its thing in the background. I've got far lower signals, and so I got a couple of these. I put one up in the living room too, so now the boys and my wife can plug in when you know their phones are off or in airplane mode, which we largely try to do at our house anyways. And that's just a super quick tip for folks, but it actually works. The only thing it doesn't do, haven't cracked the code on this, is it doesn't send text messages when you have it plugged into the Ethernet. But aside from that, it works perfectly.
I wonder, do you have an iPhone? Because you probably could go iPhone to iPhone is my guess, but you probably can't go iPhone to like Android. Oh,
okay, that makes sense. Yeah, because it seems like a couple of times a text message has sent.
Yeah.
So that makes sense.
If it's blue, you're good. If it's green, that means you're going to another provider. Or not another provider, but another type of phone system, OS.
I'm glad I have a young geek like you on the show to teach a Luddite like me. Okay, so cool. So try that out, folks, if you want to have yet another way to keep your phone from blasting with radiation, which I think we have a question about 5G later on in this podcast. We can talk about, you know, some of the things regarding that we touched on, I think, in the last podcast, but we'll get more into that later on. And then there was another really interesting article that actually I came across it just now, even though it was published in 2002, and it was about heat shock proteins. Mm-hmm. And these heat shock proteins, I think they're absolutely amazing, because, you know, essentially they're one of the main mechanisms via which you induce stress tolerance or cellular resilience. So they repair denatured proteins or injured proteins. And it's kind of interesting. Some of these long-lived mammals, one of the more famous being the extremely attractive naked mole rat, it has really high levels naturally of heat shock proteins and DNA repair, and it actually lives a disproportionately long time. And that, in addition to its high carbon dioxide tolerance, right? Like it's kind of like low breathing rate, higher amount of CO2 appear to be two of the reasons that it's living a long time. And these heat shock proteins are, of course, something that humans can tap into most popularly via the use of saunas. And I suspect this is one of the reasons why in the Finnish longevity studies, you know, we see people living a disproportionately long period of time, men in particular, from a regular sauna practice of 4 to 5 times a week. I think part of this is the cellular protection that they're getting from these heat shock proteins. Anyways, though, it turns out that in this study, they found a what's called a conditionally essential amino acid enhanced stress-induced heat shock protein expression and improved cellular survival as a result of that. And in this case, the amino acid that they used was glutamine, a very inexpensive amino acid. You can buy like bulk glutamine powder on Amazon. And so my theory here is that if you have a sauna practice, that the administration of glutamine, like just taking oral glutamine, you know, like 1 to 2 grams of glutamine, might be something that could actually kind of upgrade your sauna experience if you're looking at it from a cellular resilience standpoint. Huh. And, you know, granted, in this particular study, they were using an intravenous administration of glutamine. So they're just mainlining it straight into the bloodstream. Right. And I don't think anybody's going to wander into their sauna with an IV hooked up to them. But regardless, the dosage was not extremely high. They were using in the range of like 0.15 to 0.75 grams per kilogram. And I'm not sure how oral administration, you know, taking like a, you know, gram up to typically doses a gram to 5 grams or so of glutamine. I don't know how to compare to that. But regardless, it's pretty interesting that glutamine seems to kind of upregulate regulate heat shock protein production. So
yeah, no, that's super interesting. There are so many people too, I wonder, who are going to start asking about this, because I feel like glutamine in the past, I don't know, a few years or so, has become more or less a bad word for some people because of the deregulation of mTOR, the mTOR pathway. Do you have any take on that or any?
That's more methionine that would be the bigger issue for.
Right.
Excess stimulation of the mTOR pathway, and even that appears to not be the methionine that you get from like large amounts of muscle meat or red meat,
yeah,
but more the absence of glycine, meaning you know we were just talking about organ meats, but you know, consuming a high amount of muscle meat without consuming like the bone broth, the right. bone marrow, some of the other sources that would be in a nose to tail approach of glycine. That's the bigger issue, is a methionine to glycine balance. But glutamine, you know, it's an interesting amino acid. It appears to have a favorable impact on blood glucose, on ammonia. So like pre-exercise, it could decrease some acidic buildup. It might actually increase heart capacity or exercise capacity. Although a lot of those studies have been done in people with heart conditions. However, it's relatively safe, excuse me, inexpensive amino acid. And, you know, it's not something I use more shameless plug the Keon aminos more than I do just like isolated amino acids.
Yeah.
But regardless, something for folks to try if they're into a sauna and want to kind of, you know, I know we overuse this word, but biohack your sauna experience.
Yeah.
So they have it. And then also related to this and the heat, I have been kind of testing out this new company called Levels that helps you to monitor your blood glucose. It ties into this blood glucose, continuous blood glucose monitor called a Freestyle Libre.
Oh yeah.
And so I'm wearing a Freestyle Libre now for continuous blood glucose monitoring. I don't think it's quite as accurate as the one I've used in the past called the Dexcom G6,
mm-hmm.
but the Freestyle, it's a little bit less expensive. And they're using it now with this service called Levels. So I've been tracking my blood glucose, which I've done in the past, and I haven't learned that much interesting that I didn't already know about, you know, my response to, say, like, you know, high protein versus fat versus carb,
right.
You know, different lifestyle practices that could lower it. But I've just been extremely impressed as of late, just because of all the heat and cold and breath work that I've been doing during this quarantine, at how much the blood glucose responds to fluctuations in temperature. And for example, you know, I've talked about in the past how much cold exposure plummets blood glucose and leaves you in a low blood glucose state for a long time. Even you know, throughout the entire day, eating, consuming even carbohydrates, doing cold in the morning just seems to make you super duper insulin sensitive, or at least upregulates the glucose uptake, so glucose doesn't stay in the bloodstream for a very long period of time. And I'll link to one interesting study that I found in the show notes for today. So all the show notes are at bengreenfieldfitness.com/411. The elevation of metabolic rate due to shivering, we know that that occurs with relatively long periods of cold exposure. But even what's called non-shivering thermogenesis, it appears to cause this increase in glucose uptake and carbohydrate oxidation. Your body just burns through carbohydrates very quickly in response to cold. And so it doesn't surprise me when I'm messing around with this monitor that when I do a cold bath or a cold soak or a cold shower, I see this dip in blood glucose. But the other interesting thing is that it goes way up in response to heat.
Oh yeah, like how high?
Really high, like 150, 160.
Oh wow.
And it's a short-lived increase, you know, similar to what you get from, say, like a cup of coffee. And so I began to dig into some of the literature around this. And it turns out that there's this hyperglycemic effect that has been shown in literature in response to heat, particularly because you get an increase in certain hormones that oppose the action of insulin, particularly growth hormone and another one called glucagon. And then the other thing that happens is the dilation of the blood vessels seems to increase the speed of insulin absorption and cause these kind of unusual variations in blood glucose levels. And a lot of people, because I posted a few of my screenshots to Instagram, people were like, oh, is that a bad thing? Like, should you not be spiking your blood glucose in the sauna? And The thing is, when you actually look at studies that are more long-term on the effects of sauna on blood glucose levels, it turns out that it's one of those things where it increases temporarily when you're in the heat, but long-term, the long-term adaptations to that are actually a noticeable reduction in fasting blood glucose levels and an increase in insulin sensitivity. So it's kind of like this idea, like, yeah, your heart's like a battery, you got X number of beats for your entire life. You know, creatures with a lower metabolic rate tend to live longer. And there's something to be said for that. But of course, people always say, well, why would you exercise then? Because exercise is like increasing your heart rate. Therefore, it could be decreasing lifespan. But the idea is if you're exercising for, let's say, an hour a day, your resting heart rate the entire rest of the day is appreciably lower. So technically you're lowering your average heart rate. And the same could be said for sauna. It's going to increase your blood glucose levels while you're in there. But then a couple of things. A, it's going to be lower with a regular sauna practice as an average. And then B, if you're doing the cold right after the sauna, that spike just goes way down. It's like this rebound spike that just drops you almost into hypoglycemia. So just some really interesting things I've been finding out lately about kind of the interplay between blood glucose, heat, and cold.
That's interesting. It's like increase it in the short term to decrease it in the long term is basically what I'm hearing.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. That's cool. So yeah, kind of very, very, very similar to what we'd see in, you know, practice like hormesis, for example.
Yeah.
And then one other thing. Did you hear my podcast with Eric Weinstein? The guy who podcasts, he's like the mathematical out of LA. You know, we had a really great show, and one of the things he talked about was he's like, you know, with all the self-quantification, you'd think with people taking a dump every day that there would be some kind of like biometric evaluation one could do via their toilet on a daily basis because like these are fluids and solids coming out of your body that could theoretically be assessed on a daily basis. So
yeah, maybe for the normal person. And like yeah. for you, all I'm thinking is they're going to be like, why is this really expensive yogurt up this guy's ass?
Well, ever since we had that podcast, people have been randomly like tweeting me little like studies and anecdotes on toilets. And I had no clue. There was like this underground toilet industry where people are developing now like self-quantified toilets. And the latest one was super interesting. It was from the Biomedical Engineering Journal. And what these folks developed is a mountable toilet system for personalized health monitoring via the analysis of what they called excreta, meaning your pee and your poop.
Yeah.
And this one was really interesting because they developed this thing you put onto an existing toilet and it does urinalysis. Right. So it will analyze like proteins in your urine, bilirubin, protein, ketones, glucose, pH, like everything you'd get from a normal urine test strip. It'll test that. And then it also has what's called a uroflow meter. So it'll test like urine volume and, basically like your hydration status. And then it also has a built-in, 3D camera that analyzes this whole like Bristol stool scale. So you could actually analyze your stool classification, and not only does it look at the actual Bristol stool scale in terms of is it hard, is it firm, is it soft, etc., but then what they're doing is developing an ability to engage in what they call defecation monitoring, meaning there's like these pressure receptors on the seat surface that let's say you're constipated or you have difficulty going to the bathroom. It's actually analyzing like when you push hard and when you push easy and could be used as almost like a biofeedback tool to teach people who are constipated how to kind of like, you know, relax more, or when to breathe out, when to breathe in. Because technically you're supposed to breathe in, right, which would cause your diaphragm to expand and would help to push matter out. So you're supposed to breathe in as you're kind of like pushing out to take a poop, and then you're supposed to exhale and your diaphragm kind of goes up and that vacuuming kind of pulls the rectum up into the body. And then as you breathe out, you defecate again. Like that's how you're supposed to do it. A lot of people don't even breathe the right way when they poop. And a lot of practitioners who work with people who have difficulty with constipation or prolapse or something like that, they teach them how to breathe properly using biofeedback tools or just breath work that you do on the toilet. And it turns out this toilet seat also helps you to do that.
Well, and it's a lot less invasive too, because I don't do, it's normally like physical therapists or physicians or nurse practitioners who are doing that type of like fecal incontinence type biofeedback. And that, you know, they pretty much have to stick a sensor up your ass. Whereas at least this one, it sounds like it's just the toilet seat that's sensing the amount of pressure that you're putting on. I'm assuming kind of taking like an EMG measurement, which is really, really cool, because it sounds really invasive, but it's less invasive than what we conventionally do.
Well, how about this? How's it going to know who is pooping? And they figured out that too, because they have biometric identifications. There's a fingerprint scanner, and there's also, using the same camera, an anal crease scanner. It's essentially using the pattern of your anus to identify who you are. So it'll know, oh, this is Ben. He's taking a crap. I'm going to keep his data because I've got his fingerprint. I know what his anal creases look like. And so you can just keep track of your own data, as well as anybody else who takes a dump on your toilet's data, very seamlessly, without getting people's poop confused with another person's poop.
Yeah, makes sense. I think Apple's actually going to that. They're no longer doing Face ID. They're doing anal crease ID.
Boom. So there you go. I'll link to the study if anybody wants to take a deeper dive. I haven't actually used a toilet like that, but I love the idea of someday being wealthy enough to have one of those personal toilet systems, because right now I have one of those cheap-ass bidets from Amazon. But what I want, I visited a billionaire's house once, and I went into his bathroom, and like the toilet seat automatically opened when I walked in, and music began to play, and then, you know, you got the warm seat and the different selections for the temperatures of the bidet and whether it's going to go towards the front or the back, and like one of those high-end Japanese toilets. Someday I will make it, and I will have one of those toilets.
Yep, be taking a shit just like Mark Cuban, Ben.
Well, if you're like me, you live a busy life. You don't really have time for many days off. That's why I talk so much about your mitochondria, because they generate about 90% of the energy your body uses. And keeping your mitochondria strong is one of the best ways to keep fatigue at bay. But these little mitochondria, darn things, are expensive to run. They use a huge amount of raw materials, especially when it comes to minerals. The problem is most people, including you and me, probably don't get enough minerals. And without minerals, your mitochondria don't have the cofactors they need to make energy. More than 97% of Americans don't get enough potassium. About 80% are deficient in magnesium. 40% are deficient in calcium. And those are three of the big ones. There's close to a dozen other trace minerals that are important for mitochondrial function, and most of us don't get enough of them, and you definitely can't get them from, say, table salt. It turns out that trying to take all the minerals you need by taking single mineral supplements isn't only hard, because you need a ton of pills, but it's not the most effective way to get your minerals. That's why I take liquid, humic, and fulvic complexes. These are full spectrum mineral supplements, which means you get all the essential minerals your body needs in one go without a daily handful of massive amounts of pills or very large capsules or anything else that's hard to swallow. I use Beam mineral supplements because they're almost 100% bioavailable. They come in a liquid form that's easy to drink. It's just two bottles. I keep them in my pantry, throw back a shot a few times a day. They're a great way to refill your mineral stores, especially for those of you out here who are haunting your sauna on a frequent basis, or sweating, or doing hot yoga, or anything else. Keep your mitochondria running strong. So if you want to up your mineral game, give Beam Minerals a try. Go to Beam Minerals, B-E-A-M, minerals.com, and use code BEN at checkout for 20% off your first order. Well, if you're tired of spending hours on cardio with minimal results, then listen up, because I got a game-changing fitness breakthrough for you. The Carol Bike, science-backed, time-saving solution trusted by experts for optimizing health and longevity. They use this special form of a workout called a rehit, which allows you to achieve superior health and fitness benefits compared to regular cardio in 90% less time. That's amazing. That's a lot of time, 90%. Studies show that by doing Carol's 5-minute workout just 3 times a week, you can improve your fitness by 12%, reduce your risk of type 2 diabetes by 62%, and even wind back your internal body clock by 10 years. The science is clear. Carol Bike is your ticket to a healthier and more vibrant life. You got to try it to believe it and to see what I'm saying. I mean, it's not like a walk in the park. When you're pushing hard in those intervals, you're pushing, but then it's just like over and it's done and it walks you through it. It's very motivating. It's 5 feet away from me right now. It's right here in my office. My cool little exercise toy in my office. So you get $250 off your Carol Bike. You don't have to wait any longer. You can join over 25,000 riders and visit carolbike.com today. Carolbike.com. I get laughed at, maybe because it's a little bit woo-woo, esoteric, invisible, whatever, but I use quantum energy. I pray over my food when I eat. I try and emanate positive emotions and feelings towards people. I do like little breath work and Tibetan longevity exercise moves to charge up my body with invisible energy. And yes, I even blast my home and my body with certain quantum energy products like necklaces and little boxes that I can use to charge up food. And I get this all from this company called Lila Q. Now, I realize that some quantum energy stuff is not provable by science, but Lila does have third-party studies revealing a remarkable 20 to 30% increase in ATP production, a vital process for cells. Quantum energy has over 59 studies already done and counting. These are randomized double-blind studies these folks are doing for blood quality and HRV optimization. I can't explain it, okay? I'm not going to sit here and pretend like I can explain how quantum energy would increase blood energy or blood quality. Could be placebo. I don't know, but all I can tell you is I wear their necklace. I use their products. I blast my home with their energy. And it's called Lila Q. I've got a podcast with them, a few, if you want to take a deeper dive. But you just go to the website. Check it out. It's kind of fun to surf around. And you know what? If anything, you're going to have some cool-looking conversation products at your house and hanging around your neck. I love them. Lila Q, LEELAQ.com. Use code BEN10 for 10% off. LeelaQ.com. Use code BEN10 for 10% off. All right. Shall we launch into listener questions?
Let's do it.
Hey, Ben, this is Dale from Austin, Texas. In regards to 5G, 5G does cause respiratory issues from what I've seen on PubMed and quite a few other issues as far as toxins in the body, metals and such. What recommendations would you have for individuals to see if they have high toxic levels in their body, certain tests that you would have people take that, for your protocol? Furthermore, I have not seen anything that actually you can wear outside unless you wrap your body in aluminum foil to protect you from 5G. I see a lot of companies are coming out with stuff, but how is that verified if it actually works? Any feedback on this would be appreciated. Thank you.
So the way that I understand this question is that Dale is wondering about whether 5G, which of course has been all over the freaking news lately, and I don't think that the coronavirus is some scheme to spread 5G over the planet. Although I do have some issues with 5G, but he wants to know whether it causes respiratory issues, and also whether or not there's any way to kind of like protect yourself from 5G exposure. I guess like any of these kind of Faraday cage type of setups or shielding tools or anything like that. And so
right.
I do have a few thoughts. I just finished reading this really, really compelling book called The Invisible Rainbow. Now, I have some serious issues with the book because there's a ton of, I think, faulty assumptions on correlation and causation. You know, like all during the Spanish flu pandemic, it's the same time when radio waves began to be released at higher frequencies. That's one thing that I'm not, you know, it's kind of like the, you know, shark attacks are directly correlated to ice cream consumption. And, you know, it's really the fact that people eat more ice cream in the summer, therefore they're in the water more. You know, there's a lot of little issues in the book. But ultimately, one of the things that I did take away from the book was that there's definitely a disease of, or I don't even know if you call it a disease, but a condition of electrohypersensitivity, meaning some people really are more sensitive to what we would call EMFs, electromagnetic fields. And that book gets into how what happens is that if you're exposed to a high amount of environmental toxins, you know, in this case, the example used in the book was zinc. It affects what's called the porphyrin pathway. And these porphyrins, they're extremely important for oxygenation and for delivery of oxygen to the body. You know, there's one porphyrin containing enzyme called cytochrome oxidase, which some people may have heard of before, that resides within your mitochondria, you know, helps to deliver electrons from the food you eat and to the oxygen that you breathe. So you tend to see a disruption of these porphyrin containing enzymes in direct response to EMF exposure. And mitochondrial dysfunction is something that's often reported with things like chronic fatigue syndrome or anxiety disorder. And a lot of these people with electro hypersensitivity seem to be displaying the same type of issues. And when they do muscle biopsies in people with chronic fatigue and anxiety disorder, they do show reduced cytochrome oxidase activity. as well as impaired glucose metabolism. And most of this is due to damage of these porphyrin concepts or these porphyrin complexes. And it appears to be even more aggravated if there's a high level of environmental toxin exposure. So it does indeed seem that there's like this 1-2 combination of limited cytochrome oxidase activity combined with toxin exposure and the exposure to EMFs causing people to really feel crappy, so to speak. And it appears that that's primarily due to the impact on the mitochondria. So when we back this up, for people to understand this, so your mitochondria, they actually generate an electrical field, and it's like 30 million volts per meter. It's stronger than lightning. And the mitochondrial membrane potential, that's the charge difference between the inner and the outer membrane of the mitochondria, and it tends to be around like negative 140 millivolts. And there are books like Dr. Robert Becker's The Body Electric or Jerry Tennant's book Healing is Voltage that kind of get into this concept a little bit more, just about how the body really is something that operates largely based on electricity. And as a result, of course, electromagnetic fields are going to have an impact on that. The thing is, not all EMF is bad, right? We know that the planet Earth itself has a natural frequency. You know, it varies exactly. from 10 to 100 hertz, depending on where you're at and, you know, whether lightning is struck or whatever. But you know, one common frequency that we find is what's called the native Schumann frequency, which means that it's about 7.83 hertz. Right. And that's the electromagnetic field that you're generally getting exposed to if you're, say, standing outside barefoot. Now, the idea here is that man-made EMF, which is a lot of times occurring at much higher frequencies and higher powers, it can cause oxidation of the mitochondrial membrane and also the generation of free radicals. And there are certain things that can impact that even more. Like I mentioned earlier, environmental toxin exposure impacting the porphyra containing compounds, polyunsaturated fats, right? We know that's a big issue because they're very prone to oxidation. So if the membrane has a higher amount of polyunsaturated fats because you've been eating a lot of vegetable oil, that oxidation is going to occur to an even greater extent. And so the other thing is that, and Dr. Mercola and I talked about this when I interviewed him about his really good book called EMF, calcium channels tend to open and you get an influx of calcium into the cell. And what that can cause is more of a positive charge, like a straying away from the negative charge within the cell, this steep calcium influx, and a high amount of intracellular calcium can damage the mitochondria. So when we put all this together, you know, the issue is that all of that oxidative stress can also cause mitochondrial DNA mutations, and this can lead to more defective mitochondria, and then more defective mitochondria leads to more defective cells, and you almost get this really nasty kind of feedback loop with the more exposure to EMF, the more exposure to toxins, the more exposure to vegetable oils, and you essentially just get poorly functioning mitochondria. Now, in my opinion, and I've talked about this on the podcast before, there are certain things that you can do to alleviate some of that damage if you come at it from an electrical standpoint. So, you know, especially for these cytochrome oxidase and porphyrin compounds, we know that, for example, getting outside barefoot, you know, earthing, grounding, that has a positive impact. So does sunlight exposure or exposure to red light or near infrared light, far infrared light, the full light spectrum. And as you and I discussed on the previous episode, there are even certain compounds that can accelerate the beneficial effects of exposure to light, like methylene blue, right, or chaga, or, you know, the dark green type of compounds you'd find in chlorella or cilantro. So, you know, I would say, first of all, if you're in a high 5G or high EMF environment, get outside barefoot, get exposed to sunlight, use these red light panels, consume chaga, look into like some microdosing with something like methylene blue, use a little bit of chlorella or cilantro. You know, you're essentially like eating black and blue and green foods and getting exposed to a lot of light. And, you know, a book like The Human Photosynthesis or Syergy's new book, Regenerate, get into this in a lot more detail, this idea of the human body being able to photosynthesize to a certain extent. you know, there are other things that I think can help, you know, heat and cold to help move electrons through the body, you know, massage. We know that the fascia is almost like this piezoelectric tissue and that responds well. Having a lot of minerals and drinking good, clean, pure water. You know, these are just lifestyle practices that I think are good for generally charging the so-called human battery. Now, when we look specifically at 5G, you know, that's where it gets a little bit difficult, because I can't say that I've seen a lot of studies that directly show 5G to be damaging. I also haven't seen any studies that show it to be healthy. And that's where my concern lies. And that's, you know, that's a discussion that I had, for example, with Dr. Mercola when I interviewed him about his new book. It's also a concern brought up in what I would consider to be a well-balanced study on the effects of 5G on health, meaning not some conspiracy theory. You know, the whatever AT&T gods are like Mr. Smithers in the heaven figuring out how they're going to destroy us with 5G. Instead, like a well-balanced look at the effects of 5G. And I'll link to this study in the show notes. But essentially, what they get into in the study is that we need more studies on 5G. We need studies on what they call the dosimetry, like how the skin responds to specific frequency ranges and short intense pulses of 5G. There's no studies on inflammatory reactions. There's no study on the influence of a tissue temperature increase. Like, they haven't looked at how 5G might cause an increase in tissue temperature, which could increase oxidation. There's a lot of things that they haven't yet looked into when it comes to 5G, or if they have, that data has not yet been released. And so this particular study, it's a recent one. It was called 5G Wireless Communication Health Effects, a Pragmatic Review Based on Available Studies Regarding 6 to 100 gigahertz. And while there is some data showing 2G, 3G, and 4G to be potentially harmful and cause some of the cellular damage, the same cannot be said of 5G. So it's one of those issues where we don't really know. Yet you would think that based on what we do know about some of these other EMF frequencies, it would be prudent to take into account, you know, some of the recommendations that I just gave, and that, you know, that you would find in like that book, The Invisible Rainbow, that I mentioned, or in Dr. Mercola's book, EMF'd.
Yeah, I think people become reasonably concerned because the research is going to end up becoming come out post hoc. And I think that's where people get a little bit concerned with, because they're like, well, why can't we have these things before? And I'm like, it's just not how it works. They put these things up without kind of our approval, and then we test. And that's kind of just the unfortunate nature of the game.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, it's a rush just to allow an unregulated 5G wireless infrastructure. And, you know, again, like, I'm a very open-minded guy and I love technology. I use technology in my business. I have, you know, it's kind of like, you know, vaccines, for example. If they were to develop a vaccine that allows for a proper adaptive humoral response and an innate response to something like coronavirus, and the adjuvants in it were found to be relatively safe and not cause any damage, and there wasn't any kind of like cross contamination with animal-based retroviruses or, you know, anything else like that, I would totally vaccinate. Like, I'm very open-minded when it comes to a lot of this stuff. Same thing with 5G. If it was shown to be completely safe, I'm fine. You know, and I'll activate my phone's 5G and use that instead of, you know, 3G or 4G. So, you know, in fact, you know, the problem is that there's just not a lot of studies on it yet. So I personally plan to just play it safe. Now, there are websites that do sell, to, you know, related to Dale's other question, certain shielding tools. Brian Hoyer, who I've interviewed on the podcast before, he has a website called, fittingly enough, Shielded Healing, where he sells different paints and curtains and blankets and, you know, all sorts of things that you could use that are essentially, you know, based on this concept of Faraday caging that would completely block the signal. There's another website called Less EMF, where you can buy extremely unattractive clothing that you can wear on airplanes and look like a hooded freak in a giant white garment.
Yeah, you'll be alone. No one else is on a plane nowadays, yeah. Anyway.
Somebody needs to create actual fashionable EMF blocking gear. But, you know, I personally, you know, for long haul flights, I've got a little pair of pants and a shirt that I wear from this company in Germany that, you know, does some amount of EMF blocking. And anecdotally, I feel better when I wear that when I fly.
Yeah.
And so, So yeah, I'm not against this idea of getting some of this shielding material, but I think it's also quite prudent to do things like the sunlight exposure, the earthing, the grounding, the consumption of some of these cytochrome oxidase supports like the methylene blue or chaga or cilantro or chlorella, along with water, minerals, heat, cold, you know, any of these things that really kind of like charge the body's battery. And then as I've discussed, and I think this was also during the podcast with Mercola, you know, when you look at the calcium channel influx in response to something like EMF exposure, a diet that's rich in magnesium can help to off balance that. When you look at some of the DNA damage, a diet that includes sirtuins like, you know, cacao, red wine, blueberries or blueberry powder, et cetera, along with NAD or NAD precursors, it can help with that. And then anything regarding the modulation of some of these inflammatory pathways that seem to respond to EMF, like I believe it's the NRF2 pathway would be the primary one. Some amount of nutritional ketosis or carbohydrate mitigation or the use of these, you know, ketone esters or ketone salts. I think that's also a prudent strategy. So I think there are dietary and lifestyle strategies that are just as important as, let's say, you know, walking around with a giant Faraday cage or wearing EMF blocking underwear everywhere.
Right. No, agreed. If anybody is looking for a pretty fashionable shirt, I mean, I know it's just a shirt, but the company who I wear their underwear from, the Lambs company, I think you like them too, Ben, or you at least have talked about them before. They just came out with a shirt pretty recently, and I got one in, and they're actually quite comfy, which their underwear is comfy too, but it's fashionable as well. It just kind of looks like, I mean, some of my Viore clothes that I wear, and I would consider them to be quite fashionable.
This podcast brought to you by Lambs, right. Undies. Cool. All right, well, if anybody has anything else to add in, or, you know, or any studies that you found on 5G, feel free to let us know. Leave a comment in the show notes over at bengreenfieldfitness.com/411, just because, you know, I'm constantly learning about this stuff and keeping my finger on the pulse, so to speak, pun intended, right, of the entire EMF industry. But that book, The Invisible Rainbow, is interesting. I don't swallow hook, line, and sinker everything that the book talked about regarding like electricity and viruses and how it's responsible for every single global pandemic we've ever had. But there is some interesting data in the book. And one of the big takeaways for me was the impact on these porphyrins and cytochrome oxidase and mitochondria. So it's, I think it's worth read.
Right.
So,
hey, while we're on this EMF train, if you will, I got like, I don't know, it's probably like 20 plus like direct messages on Instagram and via my email about the last podcast we did, people asking me about my smart meter cover, the one that I had. And I know that you and I, we reached out to Brian Hoyer and he got back to us on whether or not these things were actually effective. And he did tell us via email that these things can be effective. You just have to make sure they're covering the entire meter, which the one I have and the one you linked to in our last podcast, it does cover the entire meter. So I just wanted to throw that out there because I got so many friggin' questions about that dang thing.
Yeah, I just took my tinfoil hat and threw it out there. I just got to make another tinfoil hat soon.
Yeah, there you go.
Fix that issue.
Yeah. Cheap way to do it.
Hey, this is Ben. I'm going to jump in here because although my reply hopefully was pretty thorough for you, I got some information after recording this podcast that you should know about. And this was pretty interesting to me because I reached out to my friend Brian Hoyer, who I mentioned, who I think is really a top building biologist who exists. And he had a few thoughts. So he mentioned to me that a lot of these shielding fabrics are poorly thought out because they have metal in them. So you're essentially turning yourself into a big antenna when you wear a lot of this shielded clothing. And so these 5G shielding fabrics, they've been very popular, but they haven't changed in the last 10 to 15 years. They haven't advanced with the technology, and many of them will shield things like 2.4 gigahertz Wi-Fi or sometimes close to 5 gigahertz, but they aren't coming close to, for example, 5G exposure technology and some of these more advanced technologies. So some of these fabrics, I think if you're wearing them for 5G, may not work. And I know that Brian over at Shielded Healing is working on some different forms of clothing. And I would say if you visit his website, which I'll link to in the show notes, you could, I think he has a newsletter or something over there you could probably subscribe to and kind of know when some of the shielding fabrics get better and come out. But then he also recommended, prioritization of nitric oxide, so nose breathing specifically. He feels that that would be a really, really helpful strategy to keep you out of a sympathetic state, but also to equip your body to better be able to withstand some of the cellular rigors that it goes through when exposed to EMF. And then another thing that he is a big fan of is hydrogen water, just because of the selective antioxidant capability of that, which we'll talk about later in this podcast. But he said hydrogen water should definitely be a part of like an EMF protection protocol as well. So I thought I'd throw that stuff into the hat for you. And then finally, over at Amazon, I made a list for you, a list of all the things that would be like in a 5G protection package to repair DNA, to offset the calcium influx into cells, and to downregulate the NRF2 pathway, all the things that are affected by 5G. So if you go to bengreenfieldfitness.com/5G package, that's bengreenfieldfitness.com/5G package, you can get that Amazon list that I don't think is comprised of supplements you need to take every day, but certainly if you're exposed to high amounts of EMF, that's over there. So that's at bengreenfieldfitness.com/5G package. I just put some of the same stuff I get off Amazon into a list for you if you just wanted to use the same stuff I use, like the ketone salts or the magnesium or some of the sirtuin and NAD precursors like resveratrol and a few of these other choice things that I think would be prudent. So hopefully that helps, and we'll get on to the next question.
Hi, Ben. You often recommend hydrogen water. I ordered some hydrogen tablets. I dissolved one tablet in water, drank it, and my mouth became saturated with an overpowering metallic taste. I haven't had a cold for 3 years, yet I got a canker sore within an hour and then got a full-blown cold within a day, which has taken me 3 weeks to get rid of. I have looked online and found nothing related to this. Do you have any ideas regarding this issue?
Well, first of all, I should comment that when you look at all the different forms of delivering molecular hydrogen to the body, and I have a big podcast coming out soon on molecular hydrogen, because I'm convinced that it is one of the most, it's almost like an adaptogen for inflammation, meaning it can upregulate or downregulate cytokines. It can act as a pro-oxidant, as an antioxidant. It has an effect on many of those inflammatory pathways we were talking about earlier, like the NF-kappa B pathway, the NRF2 pathway. It induces mitochondrial biogenesis. There's just a host of reasons that I really like molecular hydrogen, and I currently just put 2 tablets in a morning glass mason jar of water, typically 2 tablets in the evening-ish time, because it appears to respond well to like a diurnal dosing from a circadian rhythm standpoint. And I really am a fan of molecular hydrogen. And some of these tablets have, first of all, I should say they're, when you look at a lot of the big medical studies on molecular hydrogen, they're using high PPM air that they're infusing, like people are breathing hydrogen air, or they're using like a hydrogen IV, like saline hydrogen. But there's still some good research on just drinking hydrogen-rich water and the oral consumption of hydrogen. It is bioavailable. And although you're not going to approach, what you get from like an electrolysis-based inhalation device or IV of saline of hydrogen, you get some good results out of the use of this molecular hydrogen. And I'm a fan. The tablets themselves typically are pretty clean. Most contain some kind of an organic acid to control the pH. That's usually like malic acid or tartaric acid, some amount of magnesium. And it turns out that the magnesium is actually very bioavailable. Like a typical tablet will have like 80 milligrams or so of magnesium in it. It's actually a very bioavailable form of magnesium. So it counts towards your total magnesium consumption for the day, which is, kind of relative to what we were just talking about regarding EMF as well. And then some kind of like a binder or a lubricant. Like sometimes it's going to be like a little bit of dextrose or sodium stearyl. Some have natural flavors in them, which I'm meh on. I tend to avoid the ones with natural flavors just because you never know where the flavors were derived from. But ultimately, there's not a lot of fillers or excipients or things that need to be added to these tablets. You just drop it in water, let it dissolve, takes 3 to 4 minutes. And then because hydrogen will dissolve into the air very quickly, you want to drink it pretty soon after you've dropped the tablet in there, as soon as the tablet has dissolved. Now, regarding a metallic taste, you know, there's a reactant agent that's used with the magnesium called a metallomagnesium reactant agent. And the thing is, if it's fully dissolved in the water, those tablets, all of that reactant gets converted to hydrogen and something called magnesium hydroxide. So there should be no metallic taste if you're dissolving a hydrogen tablet in water, unless you're drinking the water before the tablet has fully dissolved, or even like actually drinking the actual tablet itself or eating the actual tablet itself. So you need to make sure you wait a good 3 to 4 minutes or look at whatever glass you poured it into to make sure that it is fully dissolved. You know, the other thing that I would consider, because some of these metallomagnesium compounds could potentially clump, you may just want to like give your water a quick stir, you know, after you've dissolved the hydrogen tablet in it, just to make sure there's no clumps in there and that it's fully dissolved. But that's the only thing that I can think of. And, you know, when he says he got a canker sore within an hour and a full blown cold in a day, you can't get a cold in one day from something that you had like that morning. So if you get a cold, it would have been from something that was in your body like days. So this could just be, you know, random correlation, or coincidence. So yeah, but ultimately I'm a huge, huge fan of hydrogen. And I would say for anybody listening in, listen to my upcoming podcast with he's an expert on hydrogen, Robert Slovak. I've interviewed him before on like alkaline water and structured water and different water filters. And we geeked out for nearly 2 hours about just hydrogen. So it's fresh on my mind. And after interviewing him, I could probably talk for another couple hours right now about hydrogen. But the long story short is I like it. I drink it twice a day, let the tablets fully dissolve. And I get mine now from his water and wellness website. So I'll link to that one in the show notes. He just has these H2 tablets. You can also get there are two other forms of hydrogen that I think are interesting. One is there's a company called HydroShot that sends them in cans, like canned hydrogen water, which is super convenient. Then there's another company called H Factor that does pouches. I think both of those you can get on Amazon, but it's like kind of done for you hydrogen water that doesn't require you to dissolve a tablet. Same thing. As soon as you open them, you got to drink the whole thing. But that could be another way to do this if the tablets bother you.
So, and I've heard this, I don't know if you've heard about this or if Robert and you talked about this. I mean, I won't say you're promoting it, but you mentioned it. So assuming that this isn't probably not the case, but I've heard like with those H factor pouches or even with the cans, there's the potential of the hydrogen dissipating, just due to kind of its nature. I don't know if that's actually true. Like,
So if the can is poorly formulated or poorly constructed, or the pouch is poorly constructed, there can be micropores or there's dead space near the top where the hydrogen can dissolve. Right. I asked him about those particular products, which is the reason I brought those two up. Apparently HydroShot for the canned version and this H Factor company for the pouched version, not only are they well formulated, but they also don't leach appreciable amounts of aluminum into the actual water.
That's good.
So those would be two examples of brands that I would actually vouch for if you're just going to purchase and drink prepackaged hydrogen water.
Yeah. The tablets are just super easy. And I actually like the taste of them. To me, this might sound odd, but when I throw a couple tablets in and I drink it, it almost tastes like it adds like a lemony taste to my water, almost like I'm drinking lemon water. Does that sound odd?
Yeah. Well, might be I don't know if it's a change of the pH at all, but yeah,
right.
That's interesting. So hopefully that's helpful, Rob, and best of luck with those canker sores, man. Don't go kiss anybody.
Hi, Ben. This is Noah. So a few days ago, I got what appears to be burnout at work, and I've started working 7 days a week because I love my work so much, and I have plenty of time each day, at least I think, to recover. It's about 7 hours of work a day, but I'm wondering, even how fun my work may be, is it true that eventually the mental energy needed to keep up working 7 days a week just wears out? Does that happen to you? Do you work 7 days a week or do you take days off? And if you do take days off, is that because of mental recovery or actually just because you want to spend more time with your kids or go on an adventure? What's a general weekly routine look like for Ben Greenfield? Thanks so much.
You ever get burnt out, Jay?
Well, right now with a newborn, I'm feeling it. But, you know, work, not so much. I think one of the things, you know, about my job and being a health psychologist is that, you know, I'm kind of trained in a lot of techniques, if you will, or lifestyle kind of options. I mean, this is what I teach my patients. So it's not something that I have dealt with. I'm also very young in my career and very driven and motivated. But I could see certainly how myself and other individuals in the healthcare space could get burnout. And I see it very often, especially working, you know, for the government like I do. So it hasn't happened as much to me, but I'm not ruling that out. It could certainly happen at any time.
Yeah, I found an interesting article that I'll link to in the show notes. That's the nine signs that you're working way too much.
Yeah.
The nine signs are one, you can't remember the last time you had a real vacation. Two is you're skipping out on your friends. Three is you're not sleeping. Four is you're suffering from hero syndrome, which would basically be you feel like you're the only one who can properly complete every task, almost like, you know, the micromanager, which I've certainly been guilty of. Next, what are we on? Number four? I think I said number four. You find yourself forgetting to eat lunch, which I never forget to eat lunch, so I'm definitely not overworking. Five, you're dreaming about work. I've had that happen before on like really, really busy weeks of work. You're dreaming about work. I think that actually is a pretty big sign.
Yeah.
Sounds dumb, but it is. Six, you never feel great, which is just immune system based and sleep based. Seven, your attitude is negative. Eight, you're missing deadlines. And then I must have missed one, or else I said nine and lost count. But it is an interesting article. Those are a few clues. If you weren't just use biometrics, like is my HRV constantly low, or, you know, is my respiratory rate constantly high or something like that. But they have definitely done research and shown that based on science, there's a certain number of hours per week that you should not work. Like working more than 10 hours a day, is associated with a 60% jump in risk of cardiovascular issues.
Yeah.
If you're working more than 40 hours a week, it's associated with increased alcohol and tobacco consumption. Mm-hmm. You know, for all those people who need the cigarette or the glass of wine, 40 hours per week does not seem like that much, but there you have it. They say little productive work occurs after 50 hours per week. Injury rates are directly correlated to work hour increases, especially once you exceed 60 hours per week. And ultimately, it appears that in most cases, somewhere around the range of more than 50 hours, and in some cases more than 40 hours, appears to be hazardous to health. Now, here's my problem with that. If you look into, and you're probably more of an expert on this than me, Jay, but if you look into self-actualization, and this idea that self-actualized people actually love their work, and for them, work and play are identical.
Right.
Which, and it sounds like Noah might be one of these self-actualized people. Then I think that a lot of that research might go out the window.
I'd agree.
Now I absolutely love my job, and my average work day these days is probably ranges from 13 to 16 hours. Like
Dang,
by the
dude.
Time you add it up, like I work 6 days a week for 13 to 16 hours. Like I get up, I'm in research, I'm reading, I have breakfast, I do the sauna, go back, I'm working another 4 to 5 hours. I have lunch, after lunch, quick nap, and then another 2 to 3 hours, workout. And then, you know, before dinner, another half hour, after dinner, typically another half hour of just cleaning up stuff. You know, Saturdays, I typically also put in a very long work day. So the thing is though, I would consider myself to be self-actualized, meaning I absolutely love my job. I love to learn about health and fitness and spirituality and nutrition, and I love to read and then get those authors on the show. And like for me, you can't keep me in bed in the morning. I wake up and I just want to go launch into the day.
Yeah.
And so I would suspect that even though, you know, I'm personally working well in excess of 80 hours per week, that I don't feel as though it's impacting my health deleteriously. You know, I still sleep 7 to 8 hours for every 24-hour cycle. I still have time with my family. I still have time to stay fit, time for hobbies. And, you know, I've kind of woven life into work. And so I think that idea of self-actualization kind of plays into this. It depends on the kind of work that you're doing. And I actually found a really good article with a bunch of essays on how self-actualized and creative people actually approach work. And the idea is that essentially work is play for these people who really succeed with a high amount of work. And then on the other hand, this idea of the whole old school Protestant work ethic or the Puritan ethic, which is kind of this idea that, you know, work should be hard. It'll make a man of you, you know, the right. long cold winter walks to school and, you know, the arduous drill type routine every single day. I think that approaching work and feeling as though it's not work unless it feels like work is probably not really going to do you much of a service versus work just being something that you're passionate about, that you absolutely love to do, that you're self-actualized during, and that you even achieve a state of flow during. I'm not saying that sometimes work is not hard. Like for me, sometimes, like, you know, I'm working on I'm working on a recipe book, and it's hard sometimes. So just, like, you know, find time during the day to sit down, to apply myself and to work on recipes. But then once I'm heads down writing, it's like, dude, I get to tell people about, you know, how to make sprouts and my different organ meat prep tactics and, you know, this recipe and just a sourdough recipe. And, you know, when I first tasted this or when I first tried that, you know, I think that ultimately, even though there's some work involved, there's pleasure derived from it that make it not as damaging as if I were to approach it as just like a, you know, hardcore buckle down, you know, Protestant work ethic style suffer fest.
Yeah. And you make a great differentiation there. And I think that it needs to be stated. You know, for me, it's one of those things, like if I wake up or even when I'm going to bed at night, if I do not have this sense of meaning, purpose, or fulfillment, then that makes me kind of question, what was it about today that happened? What's going on in my life? How is this negatively impacting me? And that's the opportunity for me to then, again, either journal or, you know, kind of just take the time to meditate on what changes do I need to make. And sometimes for me, that's been changes of completely dropping whatever it may be that's causing me a lot of struggle. And again, it's not that it's just something that causes me pain or suffering in the moment, but something that's just leading me to not feeling fulfilled or feeling passion or feeling meaning or feeling purpose. And so that's where I just have to, again, take that step back. But I think that, you know, it's a good differentiation to say that it's not to say that these things won't be hard on us sometimes. Yeah, work can be really difficult. But if it's continually making us feel unfulfilled, if it's impacting our relationship with ourselves and with others, then I think that's the opportunity that we have to take to say, is what I'm doing what I should be doing? Or do I need to kind of take another path right now or seek guidance? I mean, and guidance is something that I think is so incredibly helpful, just to kind of have that Yoda in your life, if I could throw out the Star Wars reference of the day.
Yeah. I mean, Thomas Edison has a great quote in that article I'll link to. He says, I never did a day's work in my life. It was all fun.
Yeah.
Obviously the dude worked. That's not, but he's saying, you know, based on our definition of work sometimes, maybe he didn't work. But you know, I think if you find more play in work, that's important. I think that's also why I'm such a fan of the way that I school my kids via unschooling. It's all based on creative, unstructured, free play, and they learn through that play. So as they grow, I'm hoping they develop this mentality towards work that really is more something that's based around, this is what I'm passionate about, this is what I love to do, this is what puts me in the flow. And therefore, they will hopefully from their schooling carry that into life without it just being all, you know, factory work and putting, you know, square pegs into square holes and round pegs into round holes, et cetera. So, that all being said, I do take time off. So like I mentioned, 6 days a week, I work my ass off, and, I observe the Sabbath, meaning that on Sundays, I do as little work as possible. Even workouts on Sunday are not as difficult. So the entire week, as I'm putting in all these hours and all this time, I have like a carrot on the end of a stick, this idea that, man, once I push myself, you know, away from the office Saturday night and sit down to dinner on Saturday night, it is just completely blissful all the way up until like Sunday after dinner, when I'll check in on the email to make sure there's no Monday morning fires that I'm going to need to put out. Mm-hmm. And so Sunday is a time spent with family, and it's hiking, and it's worshiping, and it's going to church, and it's playing guitar, and it's praying, and it's meditating. And as a matter of fact, when you look into the science of the Sabbath, right, and all these different religions that have one day of the week where they observe complete rest and, you know, admittedly do work hard to make sure that there is that buffer day where complete rest is possible, there appears to be really good health benefits derived from that. Now, granted, there's a lot of confounding variables because many religious people say don't drink or have some kind of a fasting practice, or in some cases may have a higher number of friends and relationships from going to church, or a better supportive community in their environment. And so I think there could be a lot of confounding variables, even though, you know, admittedly, there's a lot of people who go to church who, you know, eat Twinkies and Doritos at the church potluck. And so, you know, it kind of goes back and forth. But either way, I think that the impact of religion on mental and physical health cannot be denied. I even talk about this in Boundless, you know, things like belief in a higher power, purpose in life, friends, relationships, a meditative practice, a prayer practice, a gratitude practice, charity and volunteering in the community. Many of these things are woven into religion. And I'm not saying that you need to necessarily be religious to engage in a lot of those activities, but they're tied into a lot of these religions. And for me personally, growing up as a Christian and now still, being a Christian and structuring my life in that way, that one Sabbath day of rest is an incredible part of my weekly routine and just refreshes the entire body. And even Monday is far easier when I stick to that routine. And when Sunday is a complete day for family, for rest, for music, for fellowship, for church, for singing, etc. And so, you know, that's one big part of my week. So I would say a few things are, work is play for me because I'm approaching work from this standpoint of me being engaged in the things that I'm passionate about anyways. B, I have this one day that's completely off. And then another thing that's important is this idea, and this is kind of dumb, but a lot of people are aware of it, just the breaks throughout the day, right? I take lot of breaks throughout the day. And for me, they're super quick. They're super quick. Yeah. I mean, we're talking like 2 to 3 minute breaks sometimes. Drop 15 pushups, 30 jumping jacks, a few swings, go outside barefoot, look at the sun, walk back inside, keep working. You know, and I might do that every half hour, but there's definitely something to be said for those mini breaks spread throughout the day. And especially during the quarantine, where I've been working at home more, a lot of like mini workouts rather than like one big workout at the beginning of the day or one big workout at the end of the day. I'm like doing 15 minutes here, 20 minutes there, a little bit of breath work with the kids before dinner, and really structuring the day so that there's these multiple mini breaks, which originally was tough for me because I like to just get it all done, right? Like if I'm going to do the workout, I just want to get it done and not think about it. But spreading these mini workouts throughout the day has actually been really super duper refreshing. And, you know, for me, you know, back to the cold and heat thing, one thing that I've found to be incredible during the day and even save me some days from even needing to take a nap is one quick cold plunge, like 60-second cold plunge.
Yeah.
That can give you energy for hours. It's nuts. And I think a lot of people don't even realize how powerful that could be.
Oh, yeah. No, indeed. The thing that really kind of changed my, I'll go as far as to say life. I mean, I know it sounds like hyperbole, but I will say it's life, has been doing these Pomodoro breaks, just to kind of have some type of split in my day, because it can get so mundane, especially if you have a computer job. Now, my job's not a computer job, but I know a lot of what you do, Ben, is on the computer. But I mean, if you're just sitting there staring for hours endlessly at these screens and you don't take the time to go and move, to get up, to get out of the room that you're in, to stop staring at screens, to get out and get some fresh air, then it can be overwhelming. And so, yeah, have that break on your weekend, if it's Saturday and Sunday, or just Sunday, or just Saturday, whatever day you want to make it. But also have it spread out throughout the day, so you don't feel like I got up, you know, at 6 a.m. in the morning and didn't stop working until, you know, 8 p.m. at night. I mean, that's going to be brutal on your overall physical and mental health.
Yep. Yeah. And so, I think that kind of really helps people when it comes to giving an outline of generally how I approach work. So basically I work my ass off. I take a lot of Pomodoro breaks. I have a really set routine and schedule. I have that one day where it's completely off. And then I also just approach work from a passion standpoint. And I guess the last thing I would throw in there, because we're getting a little long in the tooth, but the last thing I would throw in there would be, if I find myself doing something that my body is screaming at me that I don't want to do, I shove that whole Protestant work ethic aside. I walk away from that task and engage in a different task. Like if I'm working on, let's say, the recipe book I'm working on right now and it's just complete mental block, I'll go dig into emails and you know, just bang it all my, because I know, okay, I'm not in a productive mode. Maybe I'm in more of a reactive mode. I can take care of some of this other stuff on my plate, then come back to this when I'm ready. And so, you know, within reason, if you're not using that as a procrastination tactic, but simply as a self-identification tactic and a realization that maybe this isn't the time that I need to be working on this, that can be helpful as well.
Right. Yeah. I think we've become so rigid or legalistic in our work day. And I think a lot of it is passed down kind of from some of our ancestors, some of them, not all of them. I think what you're doing with your kids is great. And I'm trying to do, you know, the similar thing with mine. Granted, they're 2 and 0. But I think like this idea of not being so stuck on having to do kind of what's in front of us. I know there's some things that we have to get done. They are in front of us and we have, you know, work deadlines that are not, you know, imposed on us by ourselves, but by our superiors. So there's things that have to get done, but also sometimes there aren't things that have to get done and we put that pressure on ourselves and we maintain that rigidity and that leads to burnout. So no, undoubtedly, we have to allow for some amount of appreciable flexibility or we will just throw aside everything we have and be in like a pit of despair because it can be overwhelming.
Yeah. Well, the last thing I should mention is that I do have a drink at the end of the day every day.
And you call yourself a Christian, Ben?
I know. And it's always some crazy cocktail that I mix up. Like since I got back from India, I've been doing like a little bit of gin and I put like cayenne and ginger and coriander and usually like some kind of curry and, you know, pour that over ice drink with some sparkling water, super spicy, or, you know, just like a glass of, you know, dry farm wines or some kind of organic wine. And then the other thing that I occasionally do to forego alcohol, and if anybody wants to try this, it actually works really well. These liquid ketones, which, you know, speaking of EMF, are pretty protective as it is for some of these inflammatory pathways. But the evening cocktail for me is nice. So I do that. I get high out of my mind and then I go to bed. So
right. That's my nice. My evening cocktail. I think if you haven't tried this, you should. So I'm just a big like gin and tonic guy. I love gin and tonic. Did you know that Zevia makes their own tonic?
Yeah.
You know, like the brand Zevia? Yeah.
They also do a ginger beer that's amazing for Moscow Mules.
Ooh, I need to try that. I have not tried that one. Sprouts here has the ginger, not the ginger, the tonic. And so I love just some good old gin and tonic, Zevia.
Yeah, get on it. All right, well, what do you think? Should we give something away?
Oh, yeah, we should definitely give something away.
This is the time of the show when we read a review that you guys have so kindly left. If you hear your review read on the show, leaving a review is one of the best ways to support this show. We're going to ship you a handy dandy gear pack. You just email your t-shirt size to gear@bengreenfieldfitness.com. We put together a package. We send it straight to you. Who's our lucky winner today, Jay?
Our lucky winner is Raven. Raven 3664. Who entitled their review as Excellent Fitness Education. And Raven said, Ben has a way of incorporating the most current and extreme biohacks with the old reliable values of nutrition, fitness, and family. He has the most genuine curiosity for more knowledge and packages it all up perfectly across all platforms for an education you can't get anywhere else. Couldn't recommend it more for anyone searching for their own version of fitness. So sweet.
You probably could get this education other places.
Yeah, and Boundless, but is that what you're going to say?
Yeah, Boundless. Read Boundless and you never have to listen to the podcast again. Right. Boundless will catch you up on the last 300 podcasts.
Exactly.
Shameless plug. All right, well, cool. Great review. Who was the person who read that again?
Raven 3664.
All right, Raven. Email gear@bengreenfieldfitness.com. We'll ship you out some cool swag. And in the meantime, all the show notes for everything that we just talked about, from the tinfoil hats for your balls to the books that I recommended, to all the research studies, everything, that's at bengreenfieldfitness.com/411. Jay, get back to that baby, man.
I actually literally just heard him start crying, so I'm going to go do that.
Perfect timing. All right, later, man. Well, thanks for listening to today's show. You can grab all the show notes, the resources, pretty much everything that I mentioned over at bengreenfieldfitness.com, along with plenty of other goodies from me, including the highly helpful Ben Recommends page, which is a list of pretty much everything that I've ever recommended for hormones, sleep, digestion, fat loss, performance, and
plenty more. Please also know that all the links, all the promo codes that I mentioned during this and every episode help to make this podcast happen and to generate income that enables me to keep bringing you this content every single week. So when you listen in, be sure to use the links in the show notes, use the promo codes that I generate, because that helps to float this thing and keep it coming to you each and every week.